This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the president and founder of ADSB Exchange, a flight data aggregation co-op that processes live aircraft position data from thousands of receivers around the world run by aviation and radio enthusiasts. In the news, some lawmakers want civil action against Boeing over the 737 MAX, and Netflix releases a 737 MAX documentary. United Aviate Academy will use Cirrus aircraft for training. A GA electric gas hybrid takes flight. Technology export from Icon Aircraft is probed. The FAA administrator announces he'll leave the post early, and an autonomous Black Hawk helicopter. We also have aviation news from Israel and a lot more. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 692 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is Rob Mark. He's contributing editor to Business and Commercial Aviation, part of the Aviation Week group, and he's publisher at Jetwine.com.
Hey, good evening, everybody, from beautiful downtown Chicago, where it is a balmy, it was 41 degrees here today, which is, well, as Dan knows, that's pretty neat for February.
Yeah. Well, this wait, it won't last, I'm sure.
Well, I didn't say it was going to last. I just said it was pretty nifty.
All right. Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian from the American Helicopter Museum.
Hello, all. Looking forward to a tracking conversation today.
Okay. Also with us is Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year. And an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
And I'm here. I was on assignment for a couple of weeks. That assignment was out teaching in a Cirrus Vision Jet to different clients. And that's always fun, but it's even more fun to be here with you guys.
Ah, how sweet. How were your clients? Were they good students?
Those are the only kind I work with.
Yeah. What, do you fire them if they're not good students?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Only the best for Mr. Trescott. All right. Well, our guest this episode is Dan Streufert. He's president and founder of ADSB Exchange. Now, Dan's a commercial multi-engine pilot with instrument rating. He's also a volunteer pilot with Angel Flight West. I guess he started out life in IT management. These days, Dan flies a 1966 Comanche 260B out of Falcon Field in Mesa, Arizona. Dan, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks, Max. Good to be here. Yeah, it's we're having a little bit of a cold snap here in the Phoenix area as well. It's a frigid 65 here.
I hate you. Yeah, not like Connecticut. Well, ADSB Exchange is a source for flight data, unfiltered flight data, and we'll get into more of that later. But Dan, tell us, what kind of data are we talking about here?
We have receivers that are typically run by hobbyists around the world, and they receive data on, you know, the frequency that your transponder most of the time transmits on is 1090 megahertz, and we have receivers all over that pick up all the data that comes on 1090 megahertz, and there's all sorts of that, and I could talk forever about that, but we'll get to that
later. We will later, yes. All right. Thanks, Dan. Really glad to have you with us. Mm-hmm. So first, we'll talk about some of the aviation news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready from the Midwest.
Ready from the first state.
Was Delaware the first state?
Well, that's what they say.
That's the
state motto, isn't it? The first state or the...
Yes. They were the first ones to sign the Constitution. Oh, Pennsylvania was the second.
Yeah.
See, you learn something here every day. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's why we're here.
Where's the music?
First item comes from the Seattle Times. Lawmakers demand fresh investigation into FAA decision not to penalize Boeing for MAX failures.
They mean 737 max failures, right? They don't mean max failures.
Yes, that's okay, very good.
Let's be clear on that.
Yes.
Well, and of course, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, the case against Boeing, you know, dates back to 20. When was the first accident? 2018, I think. And what they don't understand is that there were notices about the alerts that the AOA was not operating correctly that were installed in the airplanes, and then sometimes they didn't work, except that nobody even knew the alerts were there. And unfortunately, when they didn't work, they just didn't do anything. And why should they care? Well, it's not just because of an accident that could occur, but having those alerts about the angle of attack indicators was part of the certification process to get the airplane, the 737 MAX, coming down the assembly line. And so technically, was that a violation somewhere that should have been caught and dealt with along the way? DeFazio seems to think so, as well as a few other folks. And Boeing just hasn't really talked about it, and neither has the FAA. And of course, as we're going to talk later, we have a new administrator coming on board. So we know nothing's going to happen until he or she takes their seat.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, this transition period. So the DeFazio that Rob mentioned, representative from Oregon, is the U.S. House Transportation Chair. And he, along with Representative Rick Larson, who is the Aviation Subcommittee Chair, they want some civil action taken against Boeing and maybe even against individual employees of Boeing. And the two are – they're dissatisfied with the responses they've gotten from the FAA on a couple of issues. One is what Rob was talking about here, the angle of attack sensor not working. And what they say is Boeing knew that it wasn't working as it was supposed to, yet they delivered the aircraft. And another point that where they have some dissatisfaction is that in a 2013 internal Boeing meeting, there was an agreement to downplay to the FAA and other regulators the significance of MCAS. They agreed at that meeting to avoid using the term MCAS outside of Boeing. And in both of these cases, there were Boeing employees participating who were acting as FAA's authorized representatives. And they went along with these decisions. So they're very concerned, these two congressmen, and want to see some civil action taken against Boeing.
Well, and also realize that when the inspector on the line at Boeing, who is a designated representative of the FAA, says, oh, don't talk about MCAS, just keep it quiet. Okay, all right, fine. Yeah, we can do that. Well, right there, that's a conflict of interest. And, you know, we were talking, Mike and I were talking last night about this and Boeing, because we had a discussion about the that Netflix documentary, Downfall, the case against Boeing, and it makes no mention at all of the FAA. And Mike has said, well, you know, until this all kind of came down, there was no reason for anybody at FAA to chase this down and say, gee, something's unusual. And so these were indications that something was going on. And did the designees, how much did the designees know? And as the representative of the agency, did they not have a duty to report this to the FAA? But of course, you're talking about reporting your boss. Boy, that's the kind of conflict that nobody likes to see.
All of the DARs, the DERs that I've known in the past, yeah, they're in this kind of this dual role of being company employees, but being also answerable to the FAA. boy, the ones that I knew, if there was ever any conflict, boy, they sided right with the regulator side of the business. They were really kind of unconcerned about what the employer might think. But that's just my experience. This documentary, though, premiered on Netflix just a few days ago, and as Rob mentioned, it's called Downfall: The Case Against Boeing, which I thought was pretty good, although I have some observations. Did any of you other guys have a chance to see the documentary yet? No? Well, I had the same reaction, Rob, that I was kind of a little surprised that it pretty much solely focused on Boeing and didn't address some of the FAA issues as well. But I thought it was pretty good. Because we've been covering the 737 MAX so extensively over the past few years, I think we're generally pretty aware of what happened. And I was glad to see that I didn't see anything really inconsistent with how we'd been reporting on it over the past couple of years. It felt very familiar to me and a good refresher.
Well, and I had somebody with me watching it, my wife, actually, who's not a pilot. And when things came up, she said, "Didn't that cause anybody to question?" I said, "Ah, yes. But," and then later I said, "Watch, I'll bet you they're going to," and then it would mention the why nobody knew about this or that, or, they questioned the training of the Ethiopian crew more than they trained they questioned the training on the Lion Air crew. But the point was, as we said last night, the Boeing company produced an airplane that had a system in it that they didn't tell anybody even existed. When it went crazy, it looked similar to a trim runaway where the nose was getting pushed or pulled down. And everybody said, well, they should have just treated it like a trim runaway, and they should have just done this, which was to turn off the power to the trim system. But these were two guys from a third world country that went through training, but we don't know what kind of experience they had. And they were trying to deal with a brand new situation. And I think was it the FAA guy, or I think maybe it was, it said they had 10 seconds right from the first moment that the nose started to pitch over until the airplane was absolutely out of control, and realized there were warnings going off, whoop, whoop, pull up, whoop, whoop,
multiple warnings. Yeah.
Multiple warnings. And these two guys going, what the Sam Hill has happened? And to say that, well, they should have just done that, and then they would have gotten away from the problem. Well, as Boeing later admitted, okay, maybe we erred on the side of what we expected people to be able to do without training.
Yeah, so just want to jump in here, just coming from a smaller plane background, flying general aviation, things like that. I mean, the first aircraft I learned on didn't even have electric trim. So, when I first got electric trim, it was like, wow, this is great. And I suspect that, in some of these other countries, I know, GA isn't as prevalent and so forth. And if you're doing the ab initio training, you're going to jump right into that, and you're probably going to spend very little time flying the smaller planes with, manual trim, or the trim where if something happens, you can reach up with your hand and just grab it and pop the breaker and do it, just go back to doing it manually. Which is something that a lot of us pilots in the U.S. that fly a lot of small aircraft would be used to doing. So maybe they just didn't think of that. I think I was reading one of the transcripts, actually, and I don't know if it was the Ethiopian one or which one was it, but the fix for the runaway trim, obviously, was to, which is what happens when the MCAS was malfunctioning, was to actually pull the breaker. And one of the captains said, okay, we pulled the breaker. And then the other guy said, okay, well, I'm trying to roll the trim back, and I can't roll the trim back, like, physically. So then they popped the breaker back in so that they could get the power, power trim to roll it back. And the trim on the 737 must be just a different animal, because apparently it's not easy to manipulate manually if you need to.
Well, And I don't remember the exact airspeed, but of course they came down at some they were going through some hellacious airspeed before they crashed. But there is a point at which you cannot – two people do not physically have enough strength to yank on the wheel with the trim – the stab trim where it is and recover the aircraft. I mean, they couldn't – the airplane outflew them essentially.
In that 10 seconds, as you mentioned, is not very much time to react in the face of all the inputs that are coming at you then. So, but what would you say, Rob? My recommendation would be that people watch the documentary. I guess a little fearful that it would be too, I don't know, sensationalized or dramatic or, you know, overly dramatic or something like that. But I think they did a pretty good job of, you know, sticking to the facts and let the facts speak for themselves. It was interesting how, I guess, and this is something that I didn't really appreciate, I think, was that how the culture change at Boeing started when they acquired McDonnell Douglas, and how who was it that came in? Stone Cipher came in and with a different kind of viewpoint of what the objectives of the corporation. Cutting. Right. Some of that, I think, was motivated perhaps by the competition from Airbus. I don't think they emphasized that maybe as strongly. It had more of a flavor of, you know, corporate greed. And I'm not saying there wasn't some corporate greed involved, but I think some of the pressure that – well, I think a lot of the pressure that Boeing was under to reduce costs was because of the growing competition from Airbus. And then certainly when the A320neo family came out, as we've talked about, that put enormous pressure on Boeing to try to figure out how they could make the 737 competitive with that aircraft. And part of the strategy to win market share was to, you know, internally demand that pilot training, especially simulator training, would not be required of the 737 MAX pilots. But I think all those things kind of added up and caused this shift in culture. I just hope Boeing is moving in a different direction now.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. We don't know. Yeah. And of course, what got Boeing? Think about the culture from that came along from McDonnell Douglas. The McDonnell Douglas people were the people that brought you, you know, the DC-10, which was another American airline aircraft, granted much earlier, but still did that culture. We never really found out if that kind of culture did the number on McDonnell Douglas. But, you know, in these last few years, I can't tell you how many times I would look at the Wall Street before this all happened and say, look, there's Boeing, another record profit, and they're taking most of the money and buying back stocks of or shares of their own stock so that they could raise the price and the dividend. And they didn't put any money away for, you know, research. They've cut their research budget a couple of times, and I guess this is where you end up. So not many people that watched this had a whole lot of sympathy for Boeing.
Yeah, I agree. So if you haven't seen it and you have access to Netflix, recommend it. All right, moving on. Max T, we have a Cirrus article, don't we?
Oh, no, it's not a Cirrus article. This is a United Airlines article.
Ah, okay.
No, actually, it's kind of fun. It's probably the first time we were able to talk about our two favorite subjects, United Airlines and Cirrus, in the same story. So late last week, Cirrus announced that essentially United Airlines, their ab initio academy, which is called United Aviate Academy, did a fleet purchase of 25 Cirrus Track SR-20s. Now, most people probably not familiar with TRAC. That is a special version, very, very similar to the standard SR-20. But what they've done, and they've had this version for a long time, and no, I don't recall what TRAC stands for, but essentially it's for high utilization fleets where you've got lots of students going in and out, and they take out some of the really nice leather, and instead they put in some more durable materials for the seats and the floor mats and things like that. But it's otherwise, it's pretty much a standard SR-20. And they bought 25 of these with an option to buy 50 more. So essentially, people who are going to be learning to become a pilot from scratch with a track to become an airline pilot at United Airlines are going to be learning from scratch in Cirrus SR-20s. Now, I often to have conversations with pilots who are amazed that anybody would learn to get their private in a Cirrus. Oh, my gosh, what a huge mistake they must be making. I think it's interesting. I often see pilots who believe that the only right way to get a pilot certificate is the way that they got their pilot certificate. So since they didn't learn to fly in a Cirrus, oh my gosh, what a terrible thing to do. But I just want to point out that there have been a lot of fleet sales in the past for exactly this. U.S. Air Force bought 25 Cirruses about 10 years ago. The Saudi Arabia Air Force bought 25 of them, same thing. Emirates has 27 that they use to train their pilots from scratch. Lufthansa about 5 years ago bought 25. And the United has bought 25. And those are just the ones that I remember off the top of my head. There are a number of universities that have these. So anyone who still thinks, oh, no, you really have to learn in a tailwheel airplane, or you really have to learn 172. No, actually, there are a lot of people that do very well training in glass cockpit aircraft. I had a great way to compare. A number of years ago, I had two different clients come to me. One wanted to learn a Cessna 172. One wanted to learn the Cirrus. They both had 8 weeks of time. And so there was a concentrated flying for both of them. And the total number of hours came out exactly the same within 1 hour for those two. So all I can tell you is they're great airplanes to learn in. And no, it's not going to take you longer to learn to fly in one.
Has that academy actually started up yet?
It is. I actually saw something just over the past weekend that one of their first students, who I think was a woman, just passed her check ride. Oh. So yes, they have just graduated their first student.
Any chance you're going to look to becoming a flight instructor for the academy?
Well, unless the academy moves from Arizona up to California, probably.
It's a bit of a commute.
Yeah, exactly. But, it's really amazing. United says they're going to need 10,000 pilots in the next decade, and they expect to introduce 5,000 new pilots to aviation through their academy. So it really sounds to me like people who want to learn to fly with United and who don't yet have a pilot certificate might really want to consider going through their academy, because that's going to, I think, going to give them kind of an inside track to getting hired at United long term.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right. We have an item from Creamer Media's engineering news. This is first general aviation aircraft with hybrid power plant has been successfully flown. And this is kind of a collaboration, I guess you could call it, between Rolls-Royce, Technam, and Rotax, BRP Rotax. And this flight of a hybrid powered aircraft actually occurred in December last year, 2021, but they've just now announced this. And it's a parallel hybrid propulsion system, meaning that there is a 104-kilowatt Rotax engine, 915 internal combustion engine, and also a Rolls-Royce electric power system, a 30-kilowatt power system. And they can both be operated in parallel. In other words, at the same time, producing 134 kilowatts. They call this it's the Technam P2010 H3PS. And the H3PS stands for High Power, High Scalability Aircraft Hybrid Powertrain.
Clearly, the marketing department did not come up with it.
Yeah, I know.
They would pick something a little easier to remember and say.
Yeah. And so this was a flight demonstration. This is not something they're intending to market. And they flew this, I believe, in Italy. Technam is an Italian aircraft company, and it's a project that was funded by the EU, the European Union, under its Horizon 2020 Research and Innovation Program. Interesting. They say it's scalable to larger general aviation aircraft. There's a video that they put out. It's kind of a promotional video, but we'll have that in the show notes. You can check that out.
What do you think of those colors, that kind of lime green and blue and yellow? That's pretty pretty snazzy.
It is. Well, sort of the Italian styling, or I don't know, something like that. We should ask our guest from last week what he thinks about that livery. But, hybrid kind of makes sense. I kind of wonder why we haven't seen more of that.
Well, if you think about how slow regulation moves, I suspect that the FAA rules probably haven't caught up with figuring out, well, how do we certify hybrid? You know, everybody knows how to certify a piston engine, but it's like, whoa. You know, even with a new Part 23 rewrite, which would presumably make it easier, yeah, they're going to move pretty slowly because, you know, nobody wants to say yes to something new and then later find out, oops, it crashed.
And there's others working on this. Surf Air in California signed a deal in 2021 with Cessna for 100 hybrid Grand Caravans. I don't know what the status of that is. Rolls-Royce is working on a much larger electric power system, 2.5 megawatts, which is something that might be applicable to something as large as a regional airliner. And another example, Pratt & Whitney's working with de Havilland in Canada on a Dash 8 hybrid demonstrator. So we see some action taking place, but here we have an actual flight apparently successful. All right, next item. This comes from thestreet.com. It's actually based on some Wall Street Journal reporting. Chinese stake in Icon probed by government panel. So, Rob, this is sort of serious sounding.
Another one of these stories that has been going on for a while. Icon, of course, is the small amphibious single-engine airplane built out in Vacaville, California. Max T, do you know where Vacaville is?
Sure, I've been there. And I think that they have closed that plant down. I think that they're now making them all out of Florida. So, yes, they were originally built out here, but I think they've moved
Icon?
Most of the production east. Yeah, the Icon A5.
That's a new one on me.
I could be making this up, but I actually had a conversation with somebody about this a week ago, and we could
really?
Kind of both nodded that, yeah, we both agree they're being made in Florida, so maybe we're both wrong.
Well, because they've got a great plant down in Tijuana, Mexico, where most of the aircraft had been being built. I had a chance to visit it a couple of years ago, and it's a great little airplane. You could fold the wings, you could tow it behind your car and take it home if you don't have a hangar for it. You can drop it into a lake stay for the weekend, but it does have some restrictions. It doesn't like really high waves. It can't carry a whole lot. And the controversy has been that some of the people that are stockholders of the original Icon are worried, or at least they say they are worried about the Chinese investors that own 47 or 48% of the company. And that's not recently. They've owned it for 4 years, I think, maybe five. That there's going to be some kind of technology transfer of the Icon back to mainland China. And that's kind of what this article's about. Personally, I think it's a bunch of baloney. I really do. I mean, the Icon, again, it can't carry very much. They think, well, maybe the Chinese are going to make a drone out of it. The Chinese entity that owns Cirrus and Mooney, they've already dumped money into improving the Icon, getting it going, selling it. There are a lot cheaper ways to get their hands on a drone than to dump all this money into an Icon. And somehow I think it's a smokescreen.
And I'm just looking. It says that they've got a transition training center in Tampa, Florida. So maybe that's what it is, and maybe they're still building them in California. I'm not really sure. But I would agree.
Yeah, the transition facility at Tampa is what's the airport just south of Tampa International where the Air Force landed a – was it a C-17 one time by mistake? Something, but
unless their website is wrong, I quote, with composite facility located in Tijuana, Mexico, and a final assembly facility located in Vacaville, California, Icon production is up and running.
Still there then. Okay.
Still there.
And by the way, Rob, I totally agree with you. I think the amount of technology that's in this airplane, yeah, it's cool and it's got a lot of neat things. But boy, I don't think of it as being revolutionary to the point where, holy cow, you're going to get lots of amazing technology that, you know, you can use. Yeah, it's a cool airplane, but geez, I'm not sure there's tons of stuff that, you know, that would, you know, worry government regulators. I do think that there's another angle to this which might be responsible for this, and that is that I know that some of the management from the company was forced out, and that you know, they then contended that the Chinese were essentially, you know, playing unfair, and that they were transferring technology and, you know, things like that. So I think that kind of muddies the water, makes it a little hard to know how much of that is real and how much of that is disgruntled, you know, former management and investors.
Yeah, I agree.
Another aspect of this is, though, that export control items are very carefully defined. It's not just a situation where you could say, well, maybe could you think they could use this tech? No, it's not. It's not subjective. It's this specific part, that specific chip, this specific. There are lists of what is export controlled. So to my mind, it should be a pretty simple matter to say, okay, is there any of that stuff in the icon? And sometimes there can be a small little component. Boeing had this problem. I think it was Boeing a bunch of years ago. I think it was with a 737 where there was one little piece, one little part in there, sort of a kind of insignificant, but it was export controlled. And so the issue was, yeah, but can Boeing sell the entire airplane to China? Now, I might have the example wrong, but it was something like that.
Max, it's kind of like what we talked about on UAV Digest, where the last episode, where there were Russian UAVs found in the Ukraine with American and British components,
right,
as part of the UAVs.
Yeah. So there may be some politics in this. There may be some disgruntlement in this. But if there are actual export control violations of technology, that ought to be able, in my mind, that ought to be pretty easy to figure out.
Don't you think that they would have figured it out before now?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that kind of, you know, jumped out at me too. But
yeah.
Hey, maybe we're all going to live and learn.
Yeah, we'll see. From Reuters, U.S. FAA administrator says he was not pressured to step down. And I think probably everybody's heard by now that FAA Administrator Steve Dixon has announced that he's going to be leaving the FAA effective March 31st, 2022, which is before his term expires. FAA administrators serve a 5-year term, but he said that he wants to devote his energy to his family.
They always want to spend more time with their family.
Except that Dixon did a kind of a clever thing. I guess at a he was asked.
When he held up a picture?
Yeah, about why he was leaving. And he held up his phone with a picture of his family. And he said, it's been a tough couple of years for my family. I just need to go home.
Yeah, see, and when I try that and I hold up a picture and I say, I want to spend more time with my wife. And they go, that's not your wife. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. Sorry. No, I meant this picture.
Yeah, I actually find it pretty credible if Washington is not his home, and I would have to imagine that as a, you know, Delta pilot, he lived somewhere else, not at Washington. He had to move here for that job. Yeah, I mean, I can see that, especially if the family stayed at wherever the residence is and he's commuting back and forth. Yeah, there might come a point where the family goes, hey, we need you home more often. So, yeah.
Well, people are saying that he was appointed, of course, by former President Donald Trump. People are saying that maybe there was something bogus in Steve Dixon's appointment, that maybe all his paperwork didn't quite make sense, or maybe the actual appointment never really got to Mr. Dixon from the White House. It may have been completely faked. I mean, Max, I see you shaking your head. I'm not saying it's true. people are saying. They're talking, you know.
Okay, you're making all this
up. Yeah, he is. He is.
Yeah.
Trying to get a rise out of it.
We got to get prepared again.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, really much ado about nothing. You know, the guy decides that he got to choose between hanging on to his family or hanging on to his job. That's a pretty rational, you know, decision. If the job is really making your home life bad, get rid of the job.
Exactly. One final news item. David and I talked about this on UAV Digest. This is from, is that Popular Science? PopSci.com. A Black Hawk helicopter flew for the first time without pilots.
The creepiest photograph you'll ever see in aviation.
Isn't that the weirdest?
And this is coming from the UAV. This is coming from the UAV guy. You know, while it is remarkable and it was kind of interesting, we talked about this on Digest. I have grown up looking at high performance jet aircraft being converted to unmanned or no live operator, no low aircraft. And, you know, Phantoms and F-100s and F-16s. And there was just something really creepy about seeing the Black Hawk and the fact that you can really look through the aircraft and there's nobody in it. But it is quite an achievement. The thing about it is it's not just the fact that it's unmanned. It's the fact that with just a switch, it becomes a optionally manned vehicle. You can just, with one switch, you can become, it can be piloted, or by turning that switch off, it becomes autonomous. It's a remarkable feat for Lockheed Martin, Sikorsky, and everybody, and a lot of potential for thing. But again, it is one of the creepiest pictures you'll ever see in aviation.
One thing I thought was a little odd was their justification for doing that. One element of it, to give the crew, assuming there were pilots on board, time to better plan the mission ahead, and not have to worry about the details of actually operating the aircraft. I think I found that pretty tough to stomach. That two pilots would be on board and they'd care more about the weapon systems on the Black Hawk than flying the damn thing. But, you know, hey, what do I know?
So. Now, there was another article. I don't know if you saw the other article. It said, you know, it was a similar reason, but it was said so the crew could spend more time with their family.
Fake news. Fake news.
Oh, God.
Rob, but that being said, for – especially in the special operations forces, it does give you time to focus on the important flying, which is the egress and entrance of the mission and the mission profile. Flying the 20 minutes or whatever before you get into the hot environment gives you time to prepare for that other part. But the other part is, if all you have to do is move a helicopter from point A to point B in a calm environment behind lines, this would be a great way to do it. That's you're saving pilots that are having to fly the helicopters back and forth from maintenance bases up front, et cetera, so the pilots can focus on the live missions. So there are a lot of roles that the optionally manned helicopter can perform. The K-MAX has been doing it now for years. They were flying K-MAXes as optionally manned to support Marines in Afghanistan. And for the higher-risk missions, sometimes they were flying them autonomously. But the fact that you can crew it or uncrew it is really an optimal environment.
I hope they carry it far enough through so that they are also automating, and I'm serious about this, the abnormal checklist, the emergency checklist, man, a computer that could identify a problem could run through the checklist so much faster than a human who, you know, may have to go looking for that checklist, may not remember all the, you know, the memory items for that checklist. I was out doing some emergencies with a person today, and yeah, it takes them a while to dig out the emergency checklist. This really would be pretty remarkable if you basically it kind of self-diagnoses and goes, oh, we need to, you know, run the XYZ checklist and boom, you know, pull that breaker and do this and so on. And that would be pretty phenomenal.
Well, and another thing, Max, just brought up what you just brought up was, imagine if you are flying a helicopter and you are flying, you're reducing a pilot, you're flying one pilot as a mission, and that pilot becomes incapacitated. You can flip that switch and that helicopter can be flown from the ground and landed safely. You know, it's kind of like the automatic landing system now that we've talked about in the past and coming out on in general aviation. There's something special about optionally manned aircraft.
Sure, weight and balance. You don't have to have that extra weight up there in the front. And you can design certain features out of the aircraft. No longer will they need to build the relief tube into the aircraft.
Yeah, I'm sure that was a big motivation.
Well, I always thought, too, though, that part of the reason for not having the pilots was that you could send a flight of these Blackhawks into a combat area, and if you lose three of them in the process of fighting the ground in a ground attack mode, it's not the end of the world.
Well, in that case, Rob, it's a little bit. I mean, if you're flying three Blackhawks into a combat zone, you've got a half a squad of troops in the back seat. So if you're going to lose that helicopter,
that's
you're going to lose a half a squad. Two more people, it's more along the lines of, yeah, again, providing the ability for the pilots to fly the combat missions. It's the same reason why the Navy is going to the Stingray for air-to-air refueling, because it gives the air wing back to pilots that had to be tooling around in an F-18 when they could be flying, providing air-to-air refueling, when they could be flying the combat mission. So, I mean, this is a way of force multiplying, because you're keeping pilots on the front lines and not doing the rear action stuff.
So do we think the primary use of this is to be kind of like a really nice autopilot that assists the pilot on a mission, or as a fully, you know, unmanned helicopter? What do we think is the primary use?
I think the latter. And I don't know that it's
unmanned. Okay.
And I don't know that this is designed to remain technology on the Blackhawk. I think that just using the Blackhawk as the airframe to develop and test this, and yeah, you could put this on a variety of different aircraft, maybe some that aren't even flying now, but you got to develop the technology first.
I mean, the next generation of Army helicopters are going to have the optional man ability. The FARA, the future armed aircraft. I mean, the Army is looking at optional manned as an important aspect of all future rotary wing flight.
So let's take this in another dimension for just a second. I mean, I saw something that made me wonder: is Sikorsky potentially interested in competing with the likes of Joby Aircraft? Would they like to have an automated helicopter that could provide eVTOL service in the future in the commercial arena? Are they concerned that the eVTOLs might sneak in from the side and dominate a market that they will then lose because they didn't focus on it?
Well, actually, the Air Force is working with, again, we talked about this on UAV Digest last week, where the United States Air Force is looking to have urban air mobility vehicles for their own purposes. And keep in mind that this project was a DARPA project. It wasn't just Sikorsky, Lockheed Martin. It was a technology demonstrator. But I don't think Sikorsky, Lockheed Martin, Airbus helicopters, Leonardo, they're trying to compete with, although Bell Aircraft does have a eVTOL that they're playing with, I don't think they're trying to dive into that market right now. I think they're trying to expand the roles of automation in their current helicopters and the future and the military contracts.
Dan Streufert is president and founder of ADS-B Exchange. Dan, tell us a little bit about ADS-B. That's where all this data is coming from.
So, I mean, the concept of ADS-B itself, I mean, as you know, listeners may or may not know, a few years back, the FAA came up with this great idea that, you know, they could perhaps save some money on radar and also be able to view traffic in areas like valleys and behind mountains and places like that more easily if the plane itself broadcast its GPS position. So that's really at the heart of what ADS-B is instead of being interrogated by radar and the radar station figuring out where the aircraft is located, this is the transponder just broadcasts a signal out with its GPS coordinates, altitude, and other parameters. So that's really what ADS-B is, Max.
And ADS-B, of course, we know is on, well, general aviation, commercial aviation, business aviation. Is it also on military aircraft?
It's on some. In fact, you know, it's interesting. The FAA established the January 1st, 2020 deadline that, you know, a lot of folks were closely watching because that was the deadline to equip with ADS-B for most airspace within the U.S., you know, above 10,000 and within the Mode C veil and places like that. The military was actually behind on that implementation. In fact, the GAO actually interviewed me for a report they did to Congress about the fact that the military was behind on this and, you know, not meeting the deadlines and so forth. And, you know, they got an extension. Basically, you know, they said, hey, we need more time. We're not going to retrofit aircraft. They're going to be retired, things like that. But as far as military, you'll see it more on the larger transport aircraft than you will, let's say, on fighters or, you know, helicopters, things like that. They typically don't have ADS-B. And even the advanced fighters like the F-35, it's not always on. Sometimes they'll flip it on when they do a dogfight, which is kind of cool because you can watch it on the screen and see what they're doing. But then otherwise, it's off quite a bit. So, you know, whether that's for operational security or whatever.
And this data, it's broadcast uncrypted. It's in the clear, right? Anybody with the right kind of receiver can pick it up.
Yep. In fact, you know, it's the exact same kind of data. If you have a, you know, a Stratus in your cockpit or any of the other, sort of ADS-B in tools that are relatively cheap these days with, you know, low cost electronics, it's the same type of data you're getting in. So, you know, a few years back, there was sort of the advent of what they call software defined radio, which is basically a circuit or a little part you can buy for, you know, as little as $20 off of Amazon, and you can plug that into your computer. It might run from, you know, all the way up to, say, 1.7 gigahertz, you know, maybe from, yeah, it's just a huge frequency range, and you can just tell the computer, I want to listen to this frequency or that frequency or this frequency. So instead of having to purchase a custom designed circuit that's made for ADS-B, in the early days, most people purchased was a, you know, a 1995 receiver that was made to pick up digital TV broadcasts. And you just tell it to listen to the ADS-B frequency, and then you can decode all that information and pull it in. But yeah, so it's basically unencrypted over the air. It's, you know, it's called a broadcast. So, you know, obviously you can legally pick this up and listen to it. And it's pretty interesting to see what you do pick up.
And so ADS-B Exchange uses a, what would you call, a network of people with receivers that feed the data to you centrally.
Yep. So back in 2016, this sort of technology was sort of becoming more commonplace. And I was coming at it from, you know, there are a couple other websites that do similar things, but typically their angle is, hey, I want to find out if grandma's flight is on time from New York to Miami. Well, that's great, and there's a place for that. But really, what I built this for were for the people saying, you know, what's up there flying? I see a dot. I see a light flying over my house. What is that? You know, what's going on over here? What's going on over there? And for people who are really into aviation, it's just cool. So, you know, we started back in 2016. I kind of put out the word on the internet and said, hey, I've got a little server here. If people want to send data from their receivers, we'll merge it all together and we'll build one big map of the globe, you know, of everyone who's sending their data in. And it really just kind of snowballed from there. You know, more and more people started sending their data, and it started creating this huge map of, you know, basically global radar of what was going on, because ADS-B is an international standard. So, you know, right now it's built its way up. We have 7,500 different volunteers with their receivers. You know, most of them, they build themselves, or you can buy the parts, or, you know, you can, we have a small store online. You can buy the parts from us if you want and assemble your own. But yeah, we've got 7,500 of them. Half of them are in the U.S. The other half are various international places, mostly, you know, big concentration in Western Europe, let's say. It's very popular in the U.K. and the Netherlands.
Well, when you started this, did you have grand visions of creating this, you know, this large functionality, or quitting your job and earning your living from this, or was it kind of like a hobbyist kind of a thing that got out of control?
It was really kind of the latter. It was a hobbyist thing that got out of control. I mean, I started doing this, and, you know, after work, I'd be working on the computer. My wife would say, "What are you doing? You're working on that website again?" You know, like, yeah, it's pretty neat, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it was a hobby for many years, up until recently. I had an IT job that, you know, I worked for WeWork, and that's a whole different other story if you ever follow the financial markets. But anyhow, that sort of did what it did a couple of years back. And then I started doing this full time. And really, you know, we've grown the network. It's really made first and foremost for, you know, hobbyists and people who are interested in what's going on out there. And, you know, sort of the commercial aspect, I mean, yes, it does create data that we can sell and use that to pay the bills. I mean, we have two data centers and, you know, all sorts of equipment that we need to maintain and things like that. So there is a need for funding to keep that going. But really, the primary purpose is to, you know, really to serve the hobbyist that says, what's out there? What's flying? I mean, you know, you can flip it on and see interesting things like, you know, the Zephyr drone that's flying in southern Arizona, where, you know, that was a solar powered drone that can fly round the clock. Basically, I mean, it flew for days and days on end. You see all sorts of interesting stuff, the Google Loon balloons. And now that project's been canceled, you know, the other balloons that are doing whatever they're doing out of, they got some defense contractor or something. But, you know, that, and then, you know, people like to watch military activity too. Obviously, if the military is going in and doing something on a mission, they're not going to have a transponder on because they don't want the enemy to know what they're doing. But there are a lot of public missions that are broadcast, and they do leave their transponder on. You can kind of see movements and things that are going on and whatnot. So that's another popular aspect of it too. But there's all sorts of uses for this data. You know, whether you're, you know, we worked with a lot of NGOs and places like that, looking at, you know, whether it be ivory smuggling or drug smuggling or moving questionable things around.
Is that what C4ADS.org is all about?
Yes, that's correct. We have a partnership with them where we share the data, and they help us expand the network into some of the less covered corners of the globe. We can track a lot of interesting things going on that it may help to shed light on.
When I was playing over the weekend with, I don't know, some app somewhere, and I saw somebody come up on, maybe it was Twitter or something, that said, "Hey, you know, I've been tracking this this predator over the Ukraine, just doing holding patterns." And I went, "How in the world did you figure that out?" Well, while we were sitting here, I opened your app on my laptop, and it's pretty clear. There's not a whole lot of traffic around the Ukraine and Southwest Russia, and it's pretty easy. But I would have thought, just to your point earlier, that in a predator, they wouldn't have had the damn thing on unless they wanted somebody to know they were there.
I'm pretty sure it's the latter. I think most of the time when they leave this stuff on, it's because they want to send a message. If you have a stealth aircraft, you're not going to broadcast your location. But I think they want to make it clear that they're there and they're watching. That's my theory. I'm pretty sure they didn't forget to turn it off. Although through some contractors, we have heard that the Air Force was quite surprised about how much social media there is around, hey, look at where this plane's going, look at where that plane's going. And I mean, we're actually talking about doing some things with helping them increase their OPSEC to, you know, remember to turn that transponder off when you want it off.
Well, privacy is an issue that's been brought up by some. I think we know that in maybe in other services, the aircraft of corporations or wealthy individuals is not included in the publicly available data that service provides. Maybe one of the big examples that we've seen lately, of course, is the tracking of Elon Musk's plane and how I guess Jack Sweeney is the guy that is doing that. Elon doesn't like the fact that his travels are available to anybody that follows the Elon Jet Twitter account. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so really, you know, that gets down to how the protocol was designed. And it initially was designed with no thought towards privacy at all, really. And that was an afterthought for whatever reason by the standards bodies. I'm not sure why, but it was. All of these signals are broadcast unencrypted over the air. So historically, there's been a couple things that the FAA has done, you know, often in response to lobbying by the NBAA and others. And it's interesting, typically, these two programs I'm going to talk about are just in the U.S. They don't apply in Europe or other places for some reason. They haven't really done much over there. The first program is, they used to be called BAR. Now it's LAD. Basically, you know, the FAA gives out a feed of all data from their radar sites. And you can subscribe to this feed as a company or you know, say FlightAware or FlightAware 24, any of these other flight tracking places can subscribe to that. But as part of that, you have to agree not to share any data from aircraft that are on this unlisted sort of list. And it's called the LAD list right now. So really, that's not very secure because you're still broadcasting the signal. We don't have an agreement with the FAA. We don't take data from them, so we're not obligated to block that stuff. The next thing they did was the PIA program, and that's a little bit better. Basically, each plane is assigned, based on the registration, they're assigned a hex code that they put into their ADS-B transponder, and this code is typically matched one-to-one with the registration or the tail number of a given aircraft. And what the PIA program has done is allowed people to have a sort of secret or scrambled hex code that's not associated with their aircraft. So if you've got a plane and you want to fly it privately, I mean, that's probably the best way. Now, there are other ways that you could try to analyze it and figure out what that code is and things. But I mean, these are the technical aspects. But as far as, you know, is it right to release this stuff? Well, I mean, if we didn't release it, honestly, anyone with $50 in an Amazon Prime account could just get the electronics and receive it themselves. So it would be sort of an illusion of security. I mean, we're kind of shining a light on it that, hey, this data is there and it's out there. I mean, we could pretend that it's not, but it's still going to be out there. One interesting case we had is we got I was at home one day. I got a registered letter from some lawyer in Italy. And I look at this letter. And it says, you know, our client, you know, doesn't want his plane listed on your site for privacy reasons, yada, yada. Start digging into it a little bit. Look at the tail number. Look at who it's registered to. And it turns out that this client was actually and I'll use the word that the media uses, is warlord that worked for Muammar Gaddafi in Libya and is now running for, you know, the president of Libya. But you know, some other NGOs had tracked his plane and he was going to Venezuela doing some, you know, they claim shady stuff with gold and moving it back and forth. And, you know, I don't claim to know all the details on that, but I do know this guy was, you know, been accused of war crimes and torture and genocide and all kinds of things. So, yeah, I mean, there's privacy aspects, but like I said, it's kind of, privacy theater because you can pretend that it's private, but it's really not. Anyone with electronics can pick this stuff up. And there are also, I think, good reasons to, you know, shine light on some of these areas that are a little bit behind the scenes.
Are there some countries that view this this whole topic differently than we might?
Yes. Yes, there are. In fact, China recently came out and declared that, you know, sort of all of these different flight tracking sites were, you know, I think they call them, you know, accused them of espionage and so forth. And part of this centers around, I think there was a recent law that came about in China in October. It actually also affected, because there's a similar signal and a similar network that's sent out by ships. It's called AIS. And when this law took effect, you know, they cracked down on all these receivers that were receiving these signals, both for ships and boats. And in fact, it threw the shipping industry in a bit of a tizzy, because now nobody could know where their boat was because they took all these receivers offline. And, you know, they were using them logistically to track where the boat was and when it was going to be, where it was supposed to be. And it just caused a little bit of chaos. But, you know, they also did the same thing with the planes. And their line of thinking was that, oh, it can show where Chinese military planes are. Well, yeah, but if you don't want people to know, you should turn off your transponder. Hmm. You know, that seems kind of obvious. And, there are other companies that collect this same type of data. I mean, you look at the Ariane satellite network. It collects all this type of data from satellites. So it's global. And it's collecting all the same data. And so, you know, I'm not sure why China is really concerned about it. It seems, you know, maybe like, I don't know, a bit of a PR or something like that.
Well, they like control. They don't like seeing things out there that they don't agree with. And They're used to just being able to say, take that down or else. And it doesn't work like that around the world. Yeah, let me just ask you a real question. I'm watching the map right now, and I'm watching all these guys up at high altitude. Is there a way to make the map designate the locations in English?
Because that's actually one of the most common questions we get. And yes, because we're based on all sorts of open source software, so we use OpenStreetMaps to, you know, draw the map. If you go up to, there's a like a blue square on the top of the map, and you click that, that's all the overlays. You can overlay sectionals or different things. There's one called ESRI Streets. And if you choose that, that'll be in English. Yeah, because it probably, like you saw, if you're over in Ukraine, it's all acrylic and so forth. And, you know, my acrylic isn't that good.
Talk to us a little bit about the interface, or are there multiple ways to view this? I know you can view this on the website graphically, showing the aircraft. Are there other ways, or is this the way that you access the data?
Generally, yeah. I mean, we try to make, you know, unlike some of the other sites, we try not to hide anything behind a paywall or whatnot. I mean, we do have a few ads on there, but otherwise, most of the data is available, and you'll see a lot more data than you'll see at many other sites. And we try to collect all the fields that are broadcast. For example, you know, let's say you bring up the map. If you're really interested in this, it would do someone well to click on the FAQ and look at the map help section that tells you what all those little buttons on the outside do. I mean, it might look a little technical and overwhelming at first, but there are a lot of features there that you can use to navigate the map. But simply, you know, you can move the map around, click on an aircraft you're interested in. Over on the left-hand side, all sorts of interesting data will appear. And depending on the sophistication of the aircraft and the transponder, you can get interesting things like autopilot modes. You can see, you know, at times you can see what altitude the pilots have selected in the autopilot. You can see maybe what heading, if they're on a, you know, if it's in nav mode, or if it's in heading mode. You can see calculated winds. We can calculate winds based on the, you know, the air temperature and the Mach number and the indicated airspeed and so forth. So there's a lot of data you can get there, and all that's on the left hand side there. Now, if you want to take it a step further, and this is where, you know, some of our commercial customers want to go with it, is to grab all of this data and, you know, ingest it into some system where they analyze it and all sorts of things like that. Yes, we archive all this data, and we have it down to, you know, as low as every half a second resolution. and we save all this data globally, and that can be, you know, that's a commercial product that we do offer. But typically that requires some sophistication to view.
My God, the servers that you have to save all of this global data, they must be massive.
It's, yeah, there's there are quite some servers. I mean, you know, and yeah, I mean, we started off on Amazon Web Services and quickly found out that, you know, this would be not financially viable if we kept running it there. So we got some of our own equipment in a data center, and we run it that way.
Now, for the user interface that's available to the public, mm-hmm. do you have history there, or is it really just kind of live? What's in the air is what you're limited to seeing?
There is history. If you search for or click on an aircraft, you'll see the details panel on the left side, and then there's a plus sign next to history. And you can click that plus sign, and then you can go back day by day or flight leg by flight leg. We try to determine a flight leg based on what we think is a landing and takeoff, you know, from the signals. But yeah, you can scroll back. And right now, I think you can scroll back to around the first quarter of 2020. Prior to that, we have it in big data archives, but that's what we have online and available right now. Another interesting feature, too, is if you bring up a flight that you're particularly interested in, maybe, say, an accident or something like that, when you have the plane selected and you're looking at the leg on the map you want to view, if you scroll all the way to the bottom on the left-hand side, you can download a KML file and view it in Google Earth and you know, the flight paths. And we're going to be improving that, adding some more parameters so you can see vertical speeds and things like that. But it's actually all good for accident analysis. We've talked to the NTSB about using it, and they do use it for a few things.
And I'm curious, the gentleman who's tracking Elon Musk's jet, is he getting that data from your site?
Yes, he does.
Got it. All right, so where's the jet right now?
I don't know. I guess if you look at the Elon Jet Twitter account.
And he is tracking some others as well, as I understand it. Bill Gates and, you know, others of that sort. Well, one thing about the interface, it's very responsive. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, the updates are frequently, so you can see the aircraft moving. Just the site in general is incredibly responsive. Who did all the coding on this?
Well, that credit goes to the author of TAR 1090, which is the open source software that we use behind the scenes to manage all this. So that gentleman is a very skilled individual, and he's coded a lot of this stuff. So
that you're just kind of the pretty face behind this, or?
Well, I mean, it's open source. It's used in a lot of different receivers. I believe this software is used on the individual receivers too. So like if you deploy one of our receivers, or I think even FlightAware's or some of the other ones, you go to, and when you visit the webpage of your individual device, you're actually using the same software to view the local traffic as well.
And are you able to, or rather, am I able to view the locations of the receivers if I wanted to see if there's one at near a particular area that I'm interested in?
There is a way to view the general area. We don't reveal the exact coordinates because we don't want people, showing up at someone's house or whatever. But yes, sure. It's in one of the menus on the main site. You have to go back to just ADSBExchange.com, not the map area.
Yeah. Okay.
But yes, there is a way to view that. Now, optionally, if someone is, because we've had people deploy these in Iraq and other sensitive areas, they don't want people to know at all. There is a privacy flag you can set if you don't want anybody to know there's a receiver there. In fact, it wasn't actually one of our people, but there was a few years back when the Russians came into Crimea. They did find someone who was into all this technology and was doing all this, and I don't know. They accused him of espionage and hauled him off, and I don't really know what happened there. But so if that's the case in your country, just be careful.
Yes, the hardware requirements to set up a receiving station are pretty modest, right? You can use a Raspberry Pi or something of that sort.
Yes. In fact, if you have a Raspberry Pi 3, 4, or 02W, I mean, you can buy. I mean, the basic. Just to get started on, you can buy it for $39.95. You can buy the SDR stick and the little antenna and software. That's available on our site. And we don't really, you know, make money off the hardware. We're just trying to make it available for folks. So trust me when I say there's not a lot of profit margin in that. And we do ship it worldwide. We're looking for feeders. You know, we have a lot of feeders in the US. We have a lot of feeders in Western Europe. Outside of that, we're always looking to fill holes and gaps and things like that. And the further off the beaten path you are, the more likely we need to feed from your area. So
how does that process work of, you know, creating new feeders? I mean, I thought about doing something like this, setting up a receiving station in the past, but then I'm thinking, well, here I am in the middle of Connecticut. There's probably already more than enough, you know, receiving stations out there. How do you find out if it's even worthwhile to do this?
Well, I mean, for most folks, it probably, I mean, most folks do it because they're just interested in doing it. And even if there are other feeders in the area, well, that's fine. You know, you can just put up your own. But if you can't see, let's say you're close to an airport, if you can't see traffic taxiing around on that airport, well, you can, there's something you can add, because if the feeder's close enough, you'll see all the ground traffic moving around and taxiing and so forth. So part of that is because of the nature of RF and the altitudes. If the aircraft is at a high altitude, obviously you're going to get it from hundreds of miles away. There'll be a lot of people picking it up. If it's a helicopter flying down at 500 feet or something taxiing, well, you're going to need a receiver closer. So that's where you could add value in a place like that. And you know, certainly if you're even further off the beaten track, then there's even more stuff that we're not getting that could be sent in.
Yeah. This seems pretty well developed to me. Are there things in the future for ADS-B exchange that you're looking towards, or, you know, have we pretty much, you know, built the system now?
I think there's a lot of stuff we can add. I mean, I have ideas. I have more ideas than time as far as implementing them. One of them that's somewhat interesting is we have a flag that can be set to look at GPS, the status of the GPS on the aircraft, because the transponder will send different fields about the, you know, radius of containment and the different qualities of the GPS signal it's receiving. And interestingly, if you look for certain parameters, you can find areas where GPS jamming or spoofing might be going on. So that's another angle we're looking at, is being able to detect that. In fact, we can right now. I mean, typically around, you know, Turkey always has something going on, usually in the Ankara FIR for some reason. And there's something going on in Cyprus that's interfering with GPS. You'll see that. And then, you know, sometimes when you see these NOTAMs come up for interference around White Sands or, you know, the military doing exercises, you will see all of a sudden, you know, all these planes having GPS problems. So that it is an interesting way to keep track of that and look at where stuff like that is going on. You know, we've helped with some investigations in the Black Sea around, you know, Putin's place. There's some stuff going on. You know, I don't know. I just do the data. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's one angle. And you know, with drones and UAV and folks with UAV companies, especially this, you know, beyond visual line of sight kind of stuff that's going on, a lot of times they want to avoid flight paths or figure out where where are the flight paths to avoid them. And so there's a whole market around that. I mean, there's every time you turn around, there's just a new use for this data. And you say, wow, I never thought of that. Windmill companies in Europe that want to, for example, I guess people complain about the flashing red lights on the windmill, that it bothers them. So there's a new law that I believe, you know, you only turn those on when there's a plane nearby. So that's another thing that's been looked into. But yeah, there's a lot of different products. I mean, you know, mapping TCAS alerts and things like that, because we can detect that. It's all, I mean, we have the raw data on that. I didn't need to put it on the map. So, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff.
Fascinating stuff. So people can visit the webpage, the website, adsbexchange.com.
Correct.
And browse around. Take a look at the map. It's really, it's almost addictive in a way. I mean, you can just have a lot of fun looking at what's around you and going to other areas and looking at what's flying in those areas.
Yep. And a lot of people have said that it's addictive. In fact, if you go on there, you know, you can play around with the filters and stuff too. If you want to see everything above 50,000 feet or certain types, you only want to see Blackhawks, you know, you can do all that as well. So it can be addicting. I have heard that.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dan, thank you so much. Are there any other places that you might direct our audience to, or is the website's at adsbexchange.com?
adsbexchange.com is the main one. If you're, you know, there's links from there, but if you're interested in equipment, you can go to adsb.store, and we've got some equipment on there, as well as Amazon if you want to get into it. But that's the main thing.
Hey, Max T, I can see us doing a YouTube video about, okay, this is how you actually get into the ADSB exchange. And if you want to do this, you just click over there and we could be your instructional manual people, Dan. We could be famous, you know, we could be famous. We could be cool, geeky guys. We're already geeky guys, aren't we?
Yeah, I was going to say geeky. Come on. And
this is the Airplane Geeks show. I mean,
that's right. I completely lost track of that.
Well, and while you guys are talking, I'm sitting here going, where can I find the hex for Elon Musk jet? Oh, there it is. And so I found it. So anyway.
Yeah, it appears he gave up on the PIA program as of late. I don't know why, but now he's just using his normal hex again.
Okay, what's a persistence mode?
So persistence mode is if you're looking at the screen, and for example, if you're just looking at the screen normally and we lose signal for, I think it's more than 60 seconds, we'll remove the plane from the map. But if you're on persistence mode, we won't remove it. We'll just leave it at the last place it was seen.
Ah, see, Max, I'm telling you, the world needs a video that explains what all of this stuff means.
You know, I do need to make a video. It's all there in like the help section, but people don't read the help section, so I probably need to make a video.
Uh-uh. Yeah. No, they just keep clicking around and you know, that's how they figure it out.
I'm just worried that there's going to be some snatch and grab operation where Dan gets grabbed and sent off to some rendition site. So we'll have to track you as you're being.
Well, there are certain countries that I think maybe I should avoid for
stay away from.
Unfortunately, yeah. Yes.
All right, great. Thanks again, Dan.
Sure, thank you.
What's up with the geeks? Rob, you have any news for us?
Max T, what were we going? Were you going to talk about what we did the other day, or because I won't duplicate it?
I'm so old, I don't remember what we did. You go ahead and tell them.
Well, when we were we were reviewing the data on an accident that we noticed that occurred down in the North Carolina area, out near the Cherry Point Marine Corps Air Station site, where a Pilatus PC-12 crashed into the ocean, took seven people with, I think, did it not, Max?
Yeah, plus the pilot, so eight total.
And so we were just reviewing it from an instructor standpoint and saying, you know, what are the risks that we noticed that might have been taken just based on the facts that we were able to see? And I said I don't want to jump ahead because I don't know if you finished editing it yet, but is it out? Am I famous?
Yeah, it'll be episode 221, and by the time people hear this episode, it should be out.
Oh, good. Okay, so I won't sound like I made that up. But it is what we did do, though, is it is very interesting, the trends you can already see when somebody is out flying and you know a little bit about their weather, you know a little bit about the airspace, you know a little bit about the altitude they were at, and then you see them make various and sundry maneuvers that we could track on ADS-B. And you go, all right, now wait a minute, why would the guy have made a U-turn here? Restricted airspace. And honest to goodness, we talked about this before, but it's amazing how many times these short flights get people into trouble because they are so certain that, it's only a 50-mile flight. I mean, what can happen? And actually, plenty can happen. Not to mention how quickly things are happening when you take a high-performance airplane and stick it in the equation. In a 172, a lot of these accidents probably wouldn't have happened. But in an airplane doing 260 or 270 knots, boy, you're eating up ground pretty quickly. Anyway, but I won't steal Max's thunder. It's his show. And what was the name of that show again, Max?
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, Aviation News Talk. And it's funny. I feel kind of sad as you were talking about it because it's tough anytime you see an accident where eight people are, lost in a very capable aircraft, and you just kind of go, wow, how could that be? And the answer is pilots just continue to make the same kind of mistakes over and over, even in very capable aircraft.
Yeah.
All right. We have a recorded announcement from Brian. Brian's been working on his project, The Journey is the Reward, and he sent in a brief update.
Hi, Max and team. Mike and I have been hard at work recording episodes for the JourneyIsTheReward.org podcast show documentary. I'm not exactly sure what to call it. But anyway, with a lot of your help, I was finally able to get the first four episodes published on the website. Through a bunch of screw-ups, technical issues, and all, it's finally done. Well, it started. There's still a lot more learning, screw-ups, and hard work to be done, but at least now there's content where people could go and listen to the show. And what's all this content I'm talking about? Well, it's my website documenting my quest for my achievement of lifetime 1K status with the United Airlines Mileage Plus program. In order to achieve that status, I have to fly 3 million paid button seat miles, and I'm planning on doing this over the next 18 months. Well, 18 months from when I started, we're a month into it at this point. Anyway, you guys get the idea. So the site's really a bunch of information documenting my journey. Please check out thejourneyistthereward.org. Again, the important part's .org because .com was taken. No one's using it, but it's still taken, so therefore it's a .org. Have a look around, and please have a listen to the audio files. We will be adding more content as it becomes available. Oh, also, when this Airplane Geeks episode airs on Wednesday, Micah and I will be on our way to England to help the folks at Plane Talking UK celebrate their 400th show. Micah and I will be documenting our travels and the event itself, so that content will be published as soon as possible. I'm sure it will be full of hilarity. Well, it'll be full of something at least. So thank you so much for listening. This is your contributing editor and global traveler, Brian. Fly safely.
Very good. Yeah, Brian's really cranking on his project there. It's interesting to follow him, and congratulations on getting those audio files up on the website. So be sure to check those out. You click them and there's a player opens up right there. And congratulations a little bit in advance to the Plane Talking UK podcast, 400 episodes, a major milestone. And I think it's cool that Brian and Micah will be heading over there to help the guys celebrate. So congratulations to them. We have another Israeli news desk report from Eyal. And he writes in to tell us about an emergency landing of a Piper Aztec PA-23. And this occurred February 16th. The airplane took off from Haifa Airport with an instructor and student pilot. When they came back into the pattern, the right main gear failed to open. After some unsuccessful attempts to solve the problem or to retract the landing gear, the plane was rerouted to Ben-Gurion Airport, which is the main international airfield in Israel due to its much wider and longer runways. He says, in order to reduce weight in the chance of fire, the plane burned fuel for about 50 minutes while on the ground. Preparations were made by rescue vehicles and ambulances. So the pilot made a perfect landing, managed to cut off the right engine. This is a twin engine. The right engine and bring the two-blade propeller to horizontal position when it short final. The plane successfully kept near the center line and just veered off from the runway direction at the final stop. The pilot and passenger were unharmed. Now, he says, interestingly, the same airplane was involved in an accident back in 2016 where, during a go-around after a kangaroo landing, the landing gear was accidentally retracted and the plane made an unintended belly landing, damaging the propellers and landing gear doors. But he has some photos from this event, and he has permission of the photographer, so we'll post one or two of them in the show notes to airplanegeeks.com. You know, it's kind of when you look at an airplane coming down and only two of its three landing gear are down, I don't know, it makes me kind of nervous just looking at the picture, let alone what it might be like in the plane.
Yeah, and I watched an aircraft land on two wheels one time, and it was not that big a deal. It was a Cessna 172 or 182 RG, I don't recall which it was, but one of the main landing gear did not come down, and it was just kind of interesting as it settled onto the runway. The main that was still sticking out on either the left or right side just kind of smoothly bent up, and the aircraft just went sliding down the runway. So, you know, of all the different kinds of accidents or issues or incidents you could have, you know, I would say I can't really think of an accident involving one gear that was stuck up that turned out really badly. These usually turn out, you know, pretty well. I mean, of course, the bottom of the aircraft gets messed up, but invariably the people tend to walk away.
Well, yeah, but realize, too, the speeds involved. In a 172, I mean, you can get it pretty slow on before you touch down. Maybe you touch down at 40 knots or 43 knots, and the airplane pretty much stops. But I'm reading this biography from a fellow over in Germany who was an F-104 starfighter pilot. And he said that when they made a no-flap landing, the final approach speed was 198 knots because, that, of course, that airplane had no wing. It was the wings were, you know, this big.
Stubby.
But, yeah, exactly. And that was a big deal. I didn't actually ask him yet. We should have him on the show. He's kind of an interesting guy. But now that's some serious speed where you think even if we touch down – we might stop before we get to the next county. But anyway, so you're right. It's all energy dissipation. Yeah. And
that's a situation where we really do want to leave the landing gear up and turn that no-flaps landing into a short-field landing.
Yes.
Dan, have you ever had any kind of drama flying like this?
I can think of one item. This was probably like 25 years ago after I first learned to fly, and it's one of those things where you say, I won't make this mistake again. But rented a 152 out of Lake in the Hills Airport near Chicago. You know, my wife and I were just going up, poke around, and we brought a picnic basket, and we went to Lake Lawn up there. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it's a relatively short strip by a golf course and everything. So anyway, we had a picnic lunch, and you know, it was in a 152. It was a pretty warm day in Chicago. Well, being the greenhorn pilot that I am, I was taxiing back, and the taxiway kind of met up with the runway, and I looked to my right, and I said, oh, yeah, we're almost at the end of the runway. Yeah, we're at the end of the runway. This is fine. I got plenty of room. Well, you know, cranked it up, and we're going, and, you know, go to rotate, and the plane settles back down, and the trees and the road are coming up pretty quick. Like, well, I can either retard the throttle and try to stop, but I'm probably going to go through the fence and hit cars and it's not going to be good, or I can just go for it. Well, I'm not saying this was necessarily the right decision, but I went for it, you know, just, you know, balls to the wall and rotated and passed over the top of the trees with, you know, several feet to spare. And right on the other side of the golf course is a lake, and got over the lake, and I kind of went, whew. Yeah. And my wife says, oh, is there something wrong?
Oh, she didn't know.
No, she didn't notice.
Good thing.
You know, just thought it was normal, you know, so.
Yeah, good thing.
Anyway, that not saying that was the wisest choice, but it was my live and learn lesson. So.
Yeah, what you learned from that was?
Always use the entire runway in that situation and run the numbers.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Runway behind you is useless, so you might as well just use the full length of the runway.
Mm-hmm.
One more thing on AL, and this is kind of fun. Hillel, our friend Hillel, was over in Israel, and he met up with AL.
This is Hillel Glazer for the Airplane Geeks. I am in Israel, and I have the distinct pleasure of having dinner and a few drinks with our podcast friend, Eyal Shai, who, when you come to Israel, you must spend time with this guy. He could fill several weeks' worth of podcasts with the stories he brings from the Israeli Air Force, from commercial flying, from understanding the entire industry of aviation in Israel, from being a flight instructor here on the multitude of aircraft he's flown. Eat your heart out, David Vanderhoof. He's flown in the Phantom, the A4, the F-16, the F-15, and who knows what else. He's correcting me. He's got other planes too. So I'm just going to shut up and let Eyal tell you a little bit about himself and about an upcoming piece of work that he is working on.
Okay, hi everybody. I'm 65 years old and an instructor, flight instructor. And I'm going to prepare an article about flying over Israel. Israel in the recent years enjoying multiple flights that passing all over Israel from Europe to the Far East and the Middle East. And this is very interesting because it changes all the way that the Israeli authorities deal with the airspace of Israel. And there are many changes that have been done and will be done in the future. So I'm going to tell you about all of that in the future, in the near future.
Well, thank you, Eyal. In case that wasn't clear, he's going to talk about overflying Israel and how things have changed since the Abraham Accords have created the opportunity for aircraft to either land in Israel or overfly Israel and still fly on to countries that were once closed as a result of Israeli airspace being off limits to those countries. And now that there's cooperation, they can overfly Israel or even land here. And it's become quite an opportunity for airlines to cut down on flying around the sliver of land, which happens to border on the Mediterranean Sea. But that's just one area that Eyal can speak at length on. We think we have problems with the FAA on getting aircraft to be certified. There's a reason Israel stopped creating its own airplanes and certifying them here. And it's not because they're not interested in doing it. Let's just put it that way. So I'll leave it at that. And for now, aviation and entrepreneurship and innovation correspondent, Hillel, talk to you soon. Bye.
We have a photo that we'll put in the show notes, too, of the two of them. So they had a great time together. Hillel says that Eyal is a really interesting guy with lots of great stories and lots of great experiences. So, yeah, maybe we'll try to see if we can capture some of those.
And is that an Airplane Geeks badge that I see him wearing there?
It is. That's our button.
Ooh,
yeah, our pin there. Very cool. A couple of shout-outs really quick. Wally Funk. You know Wally Funk. Well, the NAA, the National Aeronautic Association, has announced that Wally Funk has been selected as a recipient of the 2021 Catherine and Marjorie Stinson Trophy. And she's recognized for Blazing Trails for Women in Aviation and Spaceflight. You remember her recall that her most recent flight was in...
Blue Origin.
Blue Origin.
New Shepard.
Right. Yes, yes. And inspiring the next generation of aerospace professionals as a pioneering member of the Mercury 13, flight instructor, air safety investigator, and oldest woman to fly in space. So congratulations to Wally Funk. Also coming up, this is coming up really fast, but it's worthwhile to mention it. The National Aviation Hall of Fame has got a webinar coming up. And this is February 28th, so it's less than a week away. It's called The Great Aero Recovery, and it's with our friend of the podcast, Richard Abalafia. Richard has he has moved to another company. We have to find out why he's done that. But he's now managing director at Aerodynamic Advisory, and he's going to be featured in this webinar. So you'll want to check that out. It's a Zoom webinar. We'll have a link to where you can register for that in the show notes.
Yeah, it's on Monday the 28th. So if it's past then, by the time you hear this, don't bother looking it up.
Don't bother. I wonder if they archive it. I went to the NAA website to see, to get an actual link to the webinar, and I really couldn't find it. So maybe they need to make it a little easier. And like I say, I don't know if they archive past webinars and if you'd be able to catch it, because Richard is always worth seeing or hearing. This guy probably knows more about the industry than anybody else. In our poll, you'll recall that we did a quick poll. Should the U.S. federal government create a national no-fly list for unruly passengers? Well, it was interesting. The initial responses were all 100% yes. But more recently, more people have responded to the poll, and it's now running about 80-20. 80% say yes, the federal government should create a national no-fly list for unruly passengers, and about 20% are saying no. So we'll leave the poll open for maybe another week. You can find that at airplanegeeks.com/poll690. On to some listener mail. We have one that's really fits right in with this episode. This is from a listener. I think it's from Pete. The brains that launched GPS, and this is from AOPA. But it's a story about Gladys West, who was born on the family farm in Richmond, Virginia in 1930. And you can kind of imagine what that was like. But she really put her mind to it. She earned a scholarship to Virginia State College, which is a historically black college. It's now Virginia State University. She ended up graduating with a bachelor's degree in mathematics in 1952, which is pretty impressive in and of itself. She taught math while she was earning her master's degree in 1955. Then hired by the U.S. Naval Weapons Laboratory as a mathematician, where she was solving complex equations. This is pre-computer, so, this is doing it by hand. And then in the 60s, she worked on an astronomical study that determined the movements of Pluto in relation to Neptune. Then came CSAT, then GEOSAT. And then to increase the accuracy of the computer models, she employed complex algorithms to account for various forces that distort the Earth, right? The Earth is not a perfect sphere. You've got things like differences in gravity and rotation and tides and, all of this stuff going on. So she and her team created a program that precisely calculated satellite orbits, which allowed for accurate position calculations. And then these computer models ended up becoming the basis for the GPS that we all know and love right now. In 2018, she was finally recognized for her contribution to GPS development by the Virginia General Assembly, and she was inducted into the U.S. Air Force Space and Missile Pioneers Hall of Fame. So very cool, very interesting story about Gladys West, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Mike Smith wrote to us, Mike flies the Sonics. I saw that at the Spurwink fly-in, which probably was a couple of years ago. But more on preheating. We talked about that in episode 690. And he notes that while it's good to get the oil warm, that's not necessarily the reason for preheating. A good preheat involves warming the entire engine block and all the metals that make up the engine. Just warming the oil makes you feel good, he says, but it isn't really what helps the most. He talks about clearances, and this was kind of interesting that the engine at construction is obviously at room temperature. And if you go above or below room temperature, well, that causes things to change shape. So engines are obviously designed to have certain operating clearances when they're warmed up. So warmer is better. Colder is not better. And that's where things begin to rub or grind in not ways that are good for the engine. There is an article from AOPA, actually, Savvy Maintenance. Cold starts are a culprit in engine damage. It talks about why preheat is important. And there's this statement in there that says really kind of interesting. It says, a single cold start without proper preheating can produce more wear on your engine in less than a minute than, get this, 500 hours of normal cruise operation. So fascinating stuff. Thanks, Mike, for sending that in. We want to mention that we lost an aviator, Gail Halvorsen, known as the Berlin Candy Bomber. David, you may recall this. This is about this pilot who he flew during the Berlin airlift and made some interesting drops.
Actually, I was fortunate enough to meet Gail at Reading at their World War II weekend. What his claim to fame was he discovered flying the Berlin airlift. They were flying into Berlin Tempelhof. Well, because of Berlin being under blockade, children were looking for food, and they were hanging out at the fence line of the Berlin Tempelhof. And as he would fly in, he would see all of these kids, and he started off just throwing out whatever chocolate he had aboard. Typical rations were chocolate bars. So he would toss out a chocolate bar. Well, the kids started to realize what airplane had the chocolate, this C-54. And he then was having people make little parachutes out of little fabric and candy bars tied to them. And eventually, as he would fly his mission into Berlin Tempelhof, they would jump out a box or hundred. Over time, it was hundreds of pounds of chocolate donated by people in the United States into little parachutes for the kids of Germany. And it became a legendary thing of how one person can make children's life better. Instead of dropping bombs on Berlin, he was dropping little bars of candy tied with little white parachutes. And he, from then on, became known as the Candy Bomber.
Yeah, amazing. I think I've met him, too. It might have been, was I at Reading the same time, that same year that you were, that you met him there? I think so. Yeah, I think we, yeah. So Patrick Wiggins sent in the article about him. Passing at age 101. And there's a kind of a nice cartoon.
To describe it, it's a little German boy holding a little parachute with a chocolate bar attached to it, waving goodbye as a C-54 flies off to the west. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
So it looks like he's dressed in a lederhosen, and he's holding a little parachute in his hand as he waves at the airplane.
Yeah, yeah. Very cool. And then one last item. I know this is long. I think Brian wrote in, different Brian, not our Brian. He said, hey, geeks, are you planning a gathering at Sun and Fun 2022? If so, I plan to attend. Currently, I'm not planning to attend this year. If everything goes according to plan, I'll be in Texas. I'll be in Texas then, but we'll see. Are any of you guys going to Sun and Fun this year?
No, I'm not.
No. Nobody.
I was going to be there, but Max, if you're not showing up, I'm canceling out.
You're going to go?
No, I don't have plans to. Okay. It's a long way from here. It takes a full day to get there.
I'm kind of disappointed at not going because I've had such a blast, you know, the last couple of years, and particularly like volunteering at the radio station there.
Well, do you guys go to Oshkosh?
I did. The answer is yes, especially for Rob and Max Trescott. Last year was my first year there. I'll definitely be back. And same for Sun and Fun. I like Sun and Fun a lot.
The last time I was at Sun and Fun, I had just gotten there and a golf cart went whizzing by me and I thought I'd flag it down to get a ride. The guy turns around and it's Rob Mark.
I remember that.
It was so funny. I had no idea it was you. You just turned around and we were both surprised.
Yeah, we were at Oshkosh one time. My wife struck up a conversation with a guy and she was talking. And after she was done, I said, you know, you were talking to Bert Rutan. And she's like, who is that? Yeah. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. 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 I met both Rutans at the Air Force Museum a few years ago, which was quite an experience. Okay. That's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank our guest, Dan Streufert, ADSBExchange.com. Check it out. It's absolutely worthwhile. And it's free, right?
It is free. Yep.
There we go. Do you have a paid plan or something as well?
If you want to give us a little something on a monthly or annual basis, you can get rid of the ads.
Okay.
Or alternatively, if you feed us data from a receiver, then we'll give you complimentary ad-free access.
Excellent. All right. Thanks again. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode are at airplanegeeks.com/692. And, of course, our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, Rob, anything you want to say before we go?
No.
Okay. David?
No.
No. Everybody's tired. Max T.
If you want to subscribe to a show that has great guests like Rob Mark on it, go out to aviationnewstalk.com.
And see, if it hadn't been for that ride, I would never have gotten this relationship going.
Oh, we knew each other before then.
I guess we did.
We even admitted to it. Admitted it, yeah.
All right. Well, please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Good night.